and welcome back to Joe's Art History Podcast, a podcast that celebrates all things art historical with me, your host and resident art historian, Joe McLaughlin. Welcome back and happy new year. It is episode 61 and we are kicking off the new year in style. What a treat I have for you today. I am interviewing the incredible Neil Eckersley, who is a double Olympian and contemporary artist. Now, Neil is a double Olympian in the sport of judo, but when he retired from the sport and he had a couple of quite major life events happen to him, he needed an outlet for his creativity and his thoughts, and he turned to art. He went back to art school, completed a degree, and he's actually gone on to become an Olympian artist in residence. Now, throughout this episode, Neil and I, of course, touch on what it was like to be an Olympic medalist, what it was like to train, to go to the Olympics, his thoughts, his feelings, and how that has now been channeled into his art. We have a wonderful conversation where we discuss what inspires him, and also we, of course, discuss the history of art at the Olympics, because, fun fact, right off the gate, everybody, art used to be an Olympic sport, and Neil and I will touch on that a little bit more in the episode. It's a great chat. Neil is salt of the earth. I'm thrilled to have met him, and this is a really special episode, which I would like to dedicate to my dad, who was also a judo player in his time and actually a judo champion in his youth. So without further ado, I invite you to sit back, relax, as Neil and I discuss being an artist and an Olympian. So judo, like what, I can't not start this without asking you, like, how did you get into judo? And I'm, like I said, I'm so excited to talk to you about this, because it's a sport that's really close to my heart because of my dad, how we grew up. And
just basically by, because obviously I'm a dyslexic kid, and when I was at school, they didn't really have a diagnosis for it. It's just classed as a naughty kid, well behaved and disruptive. And basically, in the summer holidays, my friend next door neighbour's mum said, "You two are not, you've got to do something over the summer holidays. There's no way you're driving us mad." So she found a little advert for a club in Walkden, in a very small little town just outside Salford. And they were doing like taster classes. So we went along to them, and cut a long story short, I went to the taster class. There was something about that, the coach and the experience, that they actually, for once in your lifetime, they treated you normal with a little bit of respect. Mm. And it's that first impression, that's really what kept me involved in judo for well over 40 years. Wow. So just by chance.
Yeah.
And it was just by chance. And it just seemed to be the right thing for me to do, to channel all sort of the frustration and aggression and disruptiveness. It just allowed me to channel it into one direction, and I became, became pretty good. I was never pretty good straight away. I've always had to work really hard for everything I've got, but it just seemed to fit with me, the discipline, the different language, the respect, lots of older guys teaching the younger. The whole thing just felt right for me. And I just felt very much at home in that environment.
Yeah. And was it something that, because I read a little bit of your story, obviously, and you were saying that what I was reading was you used to cycle for like an hour and a bit every day to get to training.
Yeah, that's a little bit like the discussion we just had with you. And academically, they never really put, even though I have a degree now, I went to university in Edinburgh, did all that because I wanted to do that. It wasn't really sort of qualifications about GCSEs and, it really, really struggled for that. And when I was 16, I said to mum and dad, I want to go. I saw Neil Adams. Your dad don't know who Neil Adams is. I saw Neil Adams fighting the 1980 Olympics. And I turned around to my dad and said, "I'm going to go to the Olympics." And he went, "Okay, what are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, I'm going to train full time." So that's what happened is, and one of the regional coaches, or the regional coach had a, he was a sports teacher in this sports college. And he said, "Well, just come and live with me three or four times a week and stay over and train." And that's how it all started. So initially I started to cycle every day, and he just said, "This is crazy. Why don't you just, there's a spare bedroom, just stay with us and, just stay, and it will help on the journey and help on the cycling." But at least a year, I traveled at least up to an hour on a bike every day cycling.
I mean, great exercise and a great warm-up for before you hit the mat.
Well, Yeah, it was either that because it was two buses into Manchester from, so you know, one bus into Manchester and then one bus from Manchester to Stretford because it was just outside Manchester. So, and it took like an hour and a half, but I could cycle it in less than an hour. So that was the choice. On a good day, I would go on the bike, and then on a bad day in the winter, then I would go on the bike, and then eventually he basically took me under the wing, and that's how it started. And I was training full time judo at 16 years old. But luckily, a little bit like you, my mum and dad thought, well, he isn't, you know, he's not going to amount to anything because of the options were going into factories or working down the pit or working in industry. And basically, mum and dad said, well, you know, let's, you know, they had that life, and they said, well, we didn't really want it for me, really. And if that's what my dream was, or my ambition was, they were financially they couldn't support me, but emotionally, they said, go, just go for it.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that's something that I really resonate with. Like, you might not have, especially coming from, because we come from very similar backgrounds, like, you might not have all the money in the world, but actually, like, your love and support of people can propel you further than.
Well, it's key, isn't it? At the end of the day, they could have quite easily said, no, you're going out, you know, like most of my mates, if they would have said, you're joking, you know, you're going down the pit, or you need to bring money in, you know what I mean? But at least my mum and dad said no. And my mum said they were always worried at first, like what I was going to do. They were always worried. And my dad always said, well, don't worry, he'll work it out. He'll do good in the end, you know what I mean? So they had that belief and that confidence in me. And I think they could see the commitment. I didn't, you know, it wasn't, I started at 9, and then when I was 16, I was training full time. But I was fighting in local events and national events, and they could see the commitment. So they knew it was already there. It wasn't just an overnight, fly by night, pie in the sky idea. They knew I would put the work in to get to where I needed to be.
So from seeing this Olympic medalist win, how long was it between you watching someone step on that mat and then you stepping
4
out?
years.
4 years.
I know, yeah. 16. I was in the 19, yeah. 4 years later, I was selected, one of the youngest ever to be selected for Olympic Games in the sport of judo. And the first ever Northerner as well, which is, you
Oh
know,
my
when you
God,
say
that's
ever, first
amazing.
ever Northerner, because they're all London based before that.
Yeah,
So
because they
first
trained at
Northerner.
Crystal Palace or something, they used to train.
Yeah, we used to train that all the time. Or you had to be from two of the main clubs in London, which were the Budokai and the Renshin clubs. And in the 60s, it was just all stitched up. So eventually, you know, but I was the first player from the Northwest to go to the Olympic Games. It was just crazy.
And what was that like as like just this northern lad?
As you get older, you look at it, but you know, you have to be a little bit cocky and self-assured. You know, you have to be that type of person. And to me, it was like, well, I'm going, and that's it. You know what I mean? But I wasn't going to go to make up the numbers. I was going for a medal. You know what I mean? Even at 19, and all my coaches and the national coach said, well, he's a bit young, but I embarrassed them that much. I kept beating the person that they pre-selected. Do you know what I mean? And they basically said in the end, you know, oh, wound them down and wound them down. He said, right, okay, we'll select him for a senior European, my first ever. I was still a junior, actually. So they said, we'll select him for the first senior championships, thinking I'd go out first fight. And basically said, if he gets fifth place and above, he's guaranteed to go to the Olympics. But they obviously thought, I'm not going to win the first fight. Anyhow, I lost for a bronze and got a fifth place. And that's why I went to the Olympics.
Amazing. That's just amazing. And how did it feel to, funnily enough, never spoken to an Olympian before. What was it like, the atmosphere, the adrenaline, the rush to do, because you must have to keep it all.
You do controlled and you
Yes.
captured, I'd use the word. It only really hit me is when we walked out in the opening ceremony. That's when I thought, wow, that's when I had a pinnacle moment. That I could feel it now, it's happening now. You know, the hairs and on the everything, it was just unbelievable. I thought, whoa, this is it. You know what I mean? It's actually come, it's only till you walk behind the flag in the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, that's when you're classed as an Olympian. So after that moment, you're like, you've been selected, but once you walk behind the flag, that's officially when you become, I think you when you become an Olympian. And that's when it actually, you know, like, whoa, it's actually real. You know what I mean?
And to stand on that podium with a medal is only one of the youngest judo players in
Yeah.
British history, but the first Northerner.
I know, it was strange because it was almost, even on the day, I was probably the most relaxed person in the world, but I'd done all the work. I mean, you just don't get to that level without putting the work in. So all the work was done. So it was a matter of me just going, just going out and enjoying myself. And I always used to have this thing, well, come on, I can't control the controllable, so just go out and enjoy it for me and be relaxed and enjoy it. And that's the attitude I had all the way along. And I was talking to, well, we had a security guy, a police officer, and an LA police officer who was doing all the security. And I was chatting to him about his son going to college and university. And he said, Neil, I said, I can't believe we're having conversations when you're just about to go fight for a medal. He said, why are you so relaxed? I said, because at the end of the day, there's nothing I can do about that. I can't do anything about my opponent, but I've just got to go out and fight the best I possibly can. I lost against the Japanese fighter who won it in the end. And then for the bronze medal is, remember when I said I came fifth in the Europeans? The guy who came second in that Europeans was for the bronze medal fight. And he was one of my heroes. He's an Italian player called Mariani. It's a legend. And that was a person I needed to beat for the bronze medal. And the coach, I'd already said, well, fifth place isn't bad for the first day, but there's no way I was taking fifth place, because it's like you, once you get those up, you've got to take those opportunities. And we don't, we're not privileged enough to get that opportunity again. It might never come again. So you just got to take it by the bull of, take the bull by its horns and just take the opportunity and make the best of it there and then.
And coming, so like having won your medal, flying home, there must, how did you feel flying home? Because I'm trying to think, there must have been this sense of like almost like a come down of like, oh my God, like.
Yeah, you're in this massive bubble, and LA was a party from day one. It was like, no, even the opening ceremony, it was all the Americans did really, really good, and we were like walking around like superstars. So we were kept in this bubble of amazement for like 4 weeks. But in all fairness, I wanted to get home because I missed my grandma's cooking. You just want to get home, when you've been away that long and you've done what you needed to. You want to reconnect with your own folk. You know what I mean? You want to go and see my grandma. My grandma was brilliant. She looked at the medal and she just went, "Oh, that's great. How was the food? You're all right." And that's all she was into. That. That's brilliant. I'm home now because Nan's gonna make cheese on toast for me. And that was it.
I always love going home because I don't get to go to Scotland very often, and maybe like two, three times a year. And whenever I go home, I find it like a really like grounding experience because I can do things like, so earlier this year, I curated the public art trail at Wembley Stadium, and I sent my family the photos, and there was like a big press shoot about it, and I was like, oh, I've done this thing, and they were like, all right, okay, cool. When you home next? Because
I think, yeah, I think we can't allow ourselves to go, even, going, being an artist in the Olympics. It's insane. But I don't think we've got that sort of safety. We don't allow it to go, you know what I mean? It's always under control. It's
you
because
can.
it's just, I know, because it can go, not because it can go so pear-shaped. It can just, we just know the alternative. And I just think it keeps us that balance, is not to get too above your station, because, it is amazing. It's like, but you've just got to, you've got to keep a lid on it.
You take it in your stride and like that's it, head down, crack on, like what we were saying before we
Yeah, and our parents won't know. They're not bothered. They don't know. They just haven't experienced it. So it's having a, how do you keep a conversation, and to try and explain to them what you've done? And to this day, my mum and dad are, they're very northern, you know what I mean? Oh, that's all right. And then they don't quite get it. And it's just difficult to explain. It's a different language, isn't it? Hard sometimes.
Okay, so from Olympic medalist, Olympic champion to artist,
Yeah.
where did this, what was the switch? What happened? What made you think?
Well, it was a tragedy. My older brother, I lost my older brother, who was my absolute hero. You know what I mean? He was amazing in very, very tragic circumstances. And I was just, really really struggling with it, because long story short is he was involved in an accident, or it was crazy, crazy, crazy. Went into a coma, and virtually, I had to turn him off the machine.
Oh, I'm
And
so
it was like,
sorry.
and I was just going, and I was just, it went, then this incident went to court and everything else. It was just a nightmare of a situation to deal with. And I was the only one who could deal with it, because my mum and dad couldn't deal with it, because my mum said, I've not seen him. She just wanted to have this vision of him. But I went through everything else. So that has an effect, eventually, when you're dealing with it, you're in it. But after, eventually, starts having an effect on you. And I was really kind of not losing it, but I was just not thinking right. And luckily, somebody said at the time, I said, what else were you into at school? And because I was a dyslexic, I was very drawn to sports and art, creative, you know, the creative space. And they said, right, okay. And that's when they got me my first canvas and my first easel and my first paints. And the first piece I did, one of my heroes is Jackson Pollock, and I did a very Jackson Pollock trip painting, lots of reds, lots of anger. And it just seemed to work. It just seemed to connect. Because art can be a very good therapy tool, you know what I mean, for trauma, and which it was trauma, you know, no question about it. But my older brother would be so, so proud of me, because it's that, you know, that incident, of, you know, really life-changing incident, has now opened up into a career now where we're traveling all over the world, and our the artworks here, there, and everywhere. He would be very, very pleased and very, very proud that from that difficult situation, I managed to turn it around and to go on to this journey that I'm on currently on that.
Yeah, and from your initial painting, so you said that Jackson Pollock was one of your favorite artists. How did you grow up visiting art galleries? Was it something you were introduced to from a young age? Do you always remember being quite?
Yeah, it was, because we travel. You know, we travel as Olympian and preparing for that. We travel everywhere in the world, and in all fairness, every gallery is free. And I'm a big, big supporter of free galleries.
Yeah.
Because I could go on the rest days. All my roommates, they're all being, you know, we do a month in Japan, they have a rest day, and they just lie in bed and do nothing. I said, well, you can't be in Paris. You can't be without going to the, you know, without seeing Paris or seeing Japan or seeing Tokyo, you know. And what I tended to do was, I thought, well, what I'll do is I need something totally separate from the sport. I need a different environment. And that's when I started to go around galleries and exhibitions and look at artworks in the Louvre. And I was the only one doing it, because I couldn't get anybody to come along with me to do it, really. So that's how it all started, you know, going around to galleries and looking at galleries and opening yourselves to different types of artists and different types of work.
And what was the drive to do that? Just to get out and see things and not
actually, because it's an opportunity. Life. We're never going to get these opportunities again, are you? You know, it's about going there. And some of the best cities in the world have the best, you know, some of the best galleries in the world, don't they? And 99% of the time, they can be free. Is that what I mean? Or at very little cost. So that's, you know. It was no brain. It made sense to me. That's where I needed to go to.
And did you used to read about artists as well when you started? When you sort of moved into painting? No. What was? Because you tell me the story. Like, what did you do when you started making your canvases? Was it something that you were instantly like, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, there was. Definitely. I was very good at. Like, I was very good at art at school. I mean, that's the only two teachers that I really got on with was the art teacher, Mr. Bates, and Mr. Griffiths, the art teachers, and it worked. You know, I was producing good work, and it's probably one of the strongest qualifications I got at school. Anyhow, so I was pretty gifted at. But I always, because you know, being a dyslexic, you tend to sit at the back of the class, and I was always doodling. And if you look at my work, there's quite a lot of cityscapes, and I was always doodling New York in the background, and some strange reason. And I was also, can remember doodling sort of like Miro, Picasso type things, Cubism, that type of work, you know, that type of pieces of artwork. And then when you see the artist, you go, oh, well, I'm not losing it. There is artists out there who do similar types of work. So that's how I got drawn into not reading about artists, but finding more and more and more about artists. And I think the BBC is amazing. First, we used to have the culture show, and then now we've got all the iPlayer and the art stuff and the Imagine series. It's just, you know, to watch as a dyslexic, I tend to watch more than I tend to read about artists.
So that's exactly what I do as well. And I loved that when I was researching you, there was a couple of videos on you as well, because I enjoy reading, but it's a very slow process for me reading.
It's like pulling teeth. It can be painful, can't it? For me, to read a book is very, very painful. But to watch something, to listen to something, you just got to accept that's how we learn, isn't it? You know, we're very visual.
I also think, though, most of the dyslexic people I know, myself included, like, we've got great imaginations, because you have to create these worlds and create ways that you have to understand things. But I'm really interested to know, because you said that you went to art school. And you No, you didn't go to art school.
I've never. How could I go? When could I go to art school? There's no way. I'm totally self-trained.
I read you'd gone to art school. St. Martin's, no?
I wish. No, St. Martin's. No, St. Martin's was a sports college. It's not. It was St. Martin's. I wish. Seriously, if I had another life,
Interesting.
Seriously, I would definitely have gone to art school. And sometimes, well, one of my favorite artists is Francis Bacon. He's not self-taught. You know, he is. Sorry? He's self-taught. Sorry, self-taught. Self-taught. But no. And I read and listen, don't read, I listen a lot, that a lot of artists say that sometimes if you do go to art school, they can take the rough edges off you a little bit. Well, and so a little bit feels, oh, that'd be an amazing environment to go to. But other parts, well, that's them doing all right as it is, you know what I mean? As a self-trained artist. So I've never been to art school.
Oh my gosh, I had read you. Well, that's unbelievable. Because I had read that you'd got a
Is that
degree.
better? Is that better?
That no, not at all. No, not at all. Like I was interesting anyway to see how you found the systems of like rules and things, but.
Well, I would have fought against them. I'd have been the choice of them, and I would have completely turned against them. And I think most artists do turn against the system.
Yeah.
They look at it. Luckily, I didn't have to do that.
So how do you find it then? Because judo was a very like you have to be a sort of respect. You have it's based on respect. It's based on sort of reacting to someone else's moves on the mat. Do you find that in your art practice that
Yeah,
you
it's very
are
free.
very
My,
reactive?
yeah, it's very free, and I paint on the floor. I
Oh.
don't. Yeah, paint on the floor. So the big canvases are all done on the. Everything's done on the floor. So there's lots of that physical movements. I do lots of painting with my hands, and so it's very physical painting. But it's very much more like a movement, and it's more of a meditation. And it's very similar. It's very similar to martial art, and lots of martial arts. But there is an artistic side of a martial art. You look at all the samurai warriors, they could paint and calligraphy, they could do all the art side of it as well. So there's a massive connection between being a martial artist and an artist.
Yeah, I suppose, and movement and rhythm and timing,
Yeah,
it all.
observation as well, seeing something and capturing it and seeing something and working with it and not having, because I'm as a judo player, as a judoka, judo player, I was very free flowing. Even my coach said, I don't know what you're going to do. You know what I mean? I was very much reactionary. And I think that's my artwork is very, in that way, really. I mean, I do sketch, I sketch quite a lot. And then from the sketch, put the sketch to one side and then look at the blank piece of canvas. And then the work comes out. It just comes out really natural. It's fantastic. I'm meant to be an artist.
Yeah, and do you feel this sort of freeness when you
Yeah,
create?
it's phenomenal. I did a one of my biggest paintings. It was in a judo club in Norway where we were 7.5 years, and I did a Jackson Pollock painting on this 6 foot, but roughly about 2 meters by 6 meters boards, huge things. And when I was actually throwing the paint onto the actual into the air, I could see the movement of the paint. It's almost like being in the zone as an athlete. It's the same feeling,
Yeah,
situation.
that's
Yeah,
unbelievable.
I literally could see the paint. Literally could see the paint moving, and it was like slow motion. And people say it's like being a cat. Everything just goes so slow and so quiet, and it's just like being in the zone, stepping in front of your opponent. My opponent now is a canvas and doing a piece of work, and that's how it feels. It's the same connection.
Oh, I love that. I love that analogy of just it's just you and the canvas are in this
Yeah.
thing together. I think it's fun.
Scary. Looking at a blank canvas is very, very scary, isn't it? And some that I do a painting and I'm like, oh, I'm never going to be able to do that again. It's, every artist goes through that, don't they? They're never going to be able to replicate that again. And to me, I have to paint because I think it helps. It does help with the aid, because this dyslexia, I don't know where you are, there is a certain degree of ADHD as well, you know what I mean? And I know when it's time to paint. Luckily, I have the studio here downstairs. So luckily, I can just go in and produce a piece of work.
And it's
Very
yeah.
quick, well, very quick.
Oh, I think that's so great. And what I didn't know until you answered my open call, and you sort of introduced yourself and your backgrounds and what you now is your practice as an artist, is that you were an artist in residence at the Olympics.
Beijing, yeah, which is phenomenal. And it was better for me because it was a Winter Games, so not, and it felt like representing Great Britain again. But as a
Yeah.
judoka, I've done the Summer Games, but actually to be part of the Winter Games was great as well, because that means I've totally transitioned
Yeah.
over to a winter sport.
And so tell me a little bit about the artist in residency. Like how did you approach it? How did you hear about it? Do you apply for it? Because I had absolutely no idea, but there's this whole history of
Huge.
the Olympics and
Yeah.
arts.
And they used to have a cultural program running alongside 84. They had a massive cultural. Joni Mitchell was playing, Bob Dylan was playing. They had this huge cultural event going alongside. And that's always been the case. Even in Greece, they would give medals for poetry. So it's always been in the program. And then the new sort of IGF president who'll come to be Thomas Bacher, he's now realizes the power of that, and now they've started to reintroduce that again. So every Olympic Games now, there will be a cultural Olympic Games are going alongside. And we were part of an organization called Olympian Artists, and what we've always wanted to do is come underneath the umbrella of the IOC, and now we're fully in the program. So every Olympic Games will have, and you have to be an Olympian, will be part of this program. So who better to be producing pieces of artwork than actual Olympians themselves. And a lot of the work has to be involved the core values of the Olympics. And getting the Beijing gig is, I was kind of the first person, not because my work is not sporting, some of it, but the work I did for Beijing was very, very, one was called The Zone, one was called City of Ice. And they were totally abstract contemporary pieces without a whiff of sport anywhere. And I said, look, this is what you need to do. I said, let's not look at what the Olympic artist is producing. Let's not look at the artist, what they're producing. Let's look at them as being the artist, and what they're producing is separate. If you go down this concept and like pitching it, if you go down this concept and accept my work, then hopefully it will open up into a bigger world, and kids who are not sporty might be able to see a piece of artwork that they have a connection with. So you're opening a whole new thing.
And it's really, really clever, actually, because I was reading about the history of, because there used to be and I'm going to ask you about this. And if you know, please let me know. And if not, not a problem, because it's taking me down this rabbit hole of art and sport and depicting it. And there's this whole history from ancient Greece, on friezes and sculptures of people like wrestling and chariot races. And I actually Googled what is the earliest depiction of a sporting event or sport and art.
Probably
And
a wrestler.
so sprinting, it was sprinting and wrestling. You're right, I've got the notes here, sprinting and wrestling. And it's in a cave painting
Wow.
from 15,000 years
Well, I
ago,
never knew that. That's fantastic.
which is crazy. And weirdly, I've got a friend who works at, not weirdly, but like I had never really thought of it in this context. I have a friend that used to work for the auction house Bonhams, and he was at his sale in Edinburgh. He was in charge of the sporting art sale. So it was things like fishing, shooting, all sorts of stuff like that.
All the posh stuff.
All the posh boy stuff. It was a bit, he is a bit of a posh boy, I'm sure you won't mind me saying. But it was introduced, and there used to be medals awarded at the Olympic Games for art, gold,
Poetry.
bronze,
You get
silver.
a gold wreath. Yeah, exactly the same. So there was no difference at one stage. There was no difference to from chariot racing to actually producing a piece of poetry. Everybody was medaled. I don't think they got medals. I think they got sort of gold and silver head dresses. I can't remember, but I think that's what it is. But there's been a massive connection with it. You know what I mean? In terms of, yeah. So they're bringing it back in now. So every Olympic Games now will have some form of, and they're big, big programs now. Really big programs.
Yeah,
The
and it
first one was a pilot in, I think the first one was a pilot in the Winter Olympics in Korea. But now it looks like the Paris one. They're gonna put some time and effort and some money into it as well, which is great to do.
And with Beijing, when you were the artist in residence, did you get to go out there, or were you
No,
like,
we couldn't because COVID regulations were
oh,
insane.
right,
Insane. We should
okay.
have been out there, but they didn't. So what they did is they brought in a television company, a film company, to come in to do the promo videos, which is fantastic. I mean, as an artist, there's no way I could afford for somebody to come in and pay for that. It was brilliant. That was all paid for.
I think that's the one I watched, or one of the ones.
But yeah, it's fantastic. They came in. It was amazing what they did. That's what they did. And there's only 3 minutes, but that a lot of work goes into a 3 minute video. I'll tell you now, hours, 6, 7 hours. Almost had to kick the guy out in the end. Enough's enough. I've been filmed all my life. This is enough's enough. But it's they're putting a lot of invest, and it's great because it's to me. There's not every kid sporty, are they? They could, somebody might, they can make a connection. to different type of individuals who are not that quite sports. I think it's a great program that we're doing, and we did the first one, and then I did the first. They did a really challenging interview, basically, because of Korea. They were saying, as an artist, how do you feel about Beijing? Because of all the, you know, all the history of Beijing and the, you know, the Chinese human rights, and just, and I said, well, you know, the interview being, they could do a lot of prep for it, and it's a big, massive interview to over 500 international reporters all through Zoom. And I'm saying, you know, at the end of it, I said, look, you know, this is not, I am Olympian. This is not about, you know, the Olympians are there to compete. This is not about, it's not political.
It's not politics.
No, it's not politics. They're there to, you know, and I know it's what it's like to be an Olympian. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's not what it's about. You know what I mean? So luckily that really worked well. And then I was invited to go to Lausanne to speak to those guys there and have a web webinar there. You know, so the whole program has been amazing, really.
Yeah. And is it something that you're able to do again? So, and were your pieces actually taken out? So if you couldn't go out, were your pieces on display?
They were specially photographed, and then they would put on a sort of virtual exhibition. Oh. And then there was some form of presence in there, but they kept that one quiet, so not quite sure what that particular one was. So it was a virtual exhibition. But in all fairness, I thought, well, there's more, you know, it's a good idea because more people can see it virtually than they can actually see it physically. So actually, I think they're going to continue with that because I think they've got a good reach with that. So I think I've just put the proposal in for Paris, and I'll hopefully know at the end of June whether I've been accepted. Just listen, ceremony, even though we had a great relationship, I did a lot of work for them. They love my artwork. They said it's fantastic. You know, they absolutely love what I produced, and and it was so quick, so professional. Everything was delivered on time within budget because that's what we do.
Yeah.
And you know, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that I'll be involved in Paris. So I've got a couple of really good ideas for Paris. They've just got to accept that, and then we'll go through the contractual stage, and we have to sign a disclosure that we can't say anything. And it's a scary process, but it'll be worth doing because I think there'll be more, as an artist, I'll have more of a presence in Paris. Hopefully I can go to the Olympics, and hopefully we can do work with some workshops and engage the kids, you know, young people even more. So we'll just have to wait. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think it's so exciting that a huge enterprise, really global event like the Olympics, sees the value in art as a communication tool, as a tool for expression, as a tool to support what they're trying to do in terms of exercise. And it's, yeah, I mean,
but they're playing catch up. The International Judo Federation were doing this 3 or 4 years ago. Marius Visser, Marius Visser was doing big sports. We're doing this because they had a big sort of delegation every 2 years at the World Championships. So Marius Visser, well, that wouldn't be great if we did something. You know, he's been doing it 4 or 5, 6 years ago. So Marius Visser has been very much, you know, on key with this. You know, he's the president of the International Judo Federation, and that's when I first started. The first gigs were at the World Championships, the first ever exhibition, and that's amazing. Going as a judo player to an exhibition, and your peers are actually going to the exhibition.
Yeah.
These guys growing up with your heroes, and it's like you're sat there with 10 pieces of artwork, and you're looking at the reaction, and that's been amazing about it. You know, you do get a lot of criticism. I got a lot of criticism at first. Oh, you're a judo player, you're not just happy being an Olympian. No, I'm an artist. And luckily, when they had the first ever exhibition, Yamashita was an Olympic champion, legends, all these legends I grew up with who were my heroes, all came to the exhibition, and they were just so positive about it. You know what I mean? I know. So I came, I turned from a judoka, judo player, literally in seconds, to an artist, because my peers and my heroes were accepting and actually acknowledging and being very, very positive about the work that was on display.
Well, I suppose it goes back to that respect thing, isn't it? And did you have a lot of pushback when you decided to change?
Yeah, I did. And so, because I've always, you know, I've had a career in judo a long, long time, national coach, but I worked in Norway, and I just needed something else. And it's not being me being big headed. It just this feels right for me. This is what I should have always been. It's strange.
Yeah. So I have a lot of people that listen to this podcast that are, they have like an art practice on the side, and they're thinking about starting an art practice. They're not too sure. I've got a lot of young people that actually listen to this. I've had a few people write me to be like, you've inspired me through like your talks with artists to go to art school. And it's amazing to receive messages like that. But what would you say to anyone listening that's sort of like, Dabbling.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't dabble. You've either got to be too feed in or too feed out. It's not one of those you can dibble dabble in it, and you can. I mean, luckily, we're in a position where the artwork, we're okay, you know what I mean? But it'd be very difficult these days to survive as an artist alone on selling your work. But unfortunately, I've had that. And to me, people kept saying that, well, it's going to be difficult. The career is going to be difficult. And it's the same things I heard when I was a kid when I said I was going to go to the Olympics. So to me, I'd already done it anyhow. You know what I mean? Already prepared. If I could get my chance again, so I would definitely go to art college or to art school and learn as much as you possibly can. Before you make that step, learn as much as you possibly can. Look at the artist, do the research, concentrate on your own practice. Don't be scared to make mistakes. But at the end of all that, you still want to jump in, then you're going to be more prepared than anything if you've done the background stuff as well.
Oh, I love that. And what are you up to now? Because Beijing 2020 done, as in
Yeah.
you've applied for Paris.
Yeah, we're waiting for Paris to come along. We do quite, you know, I did a really great piece because my dad's got dementia, so he's in a home. So I did a really good piece on trying to capturing what the dementia piece was amazing. It's just three different head sculpts, fantastic, really. So now I'm painting, and I listened to a really good artist and a web thing about him, and he basically said, stop worrying about making. I'm just producing art. I'm not worrying about selling it. That makes sense. Even though I'm just doing the practice and really, really enjoying that stage in our lives. Well, luckily we've got to that stage in our lives where I don't have to worry about paying the bills. You know, man, I'm just doing the practice, and I'm in the studio every day. I'm sort of working on my sketchbooks every day, and I'm just waiting for those opportunities and for those moments to come up where I can show my work to a much, much larger audience. And I think that's what I'm working towards now, certainly with the social media and promoting. So lots of promotions, lots of working. That's just, what do artists do all day? So keeping very busy.
Yeah, absolutely. Neil, it's been amazing, amazing to speak to you. I've really loved speaking to you. I've really loved researching you. This has been an episode really close to my heart because obviously this is
Well,
my dad, and I'm so excited for him to listen to it as well.
now, wishing my best when you speak to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
That name does ring a bell, but it was obviously before. He's a little bit older than me, but it was obviously before my
He's a
generation.
good bit older than you, I'll see it.
I would be able to pick up the phone now and speak to somebody who would probably know your dad.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll put you in touch actually, because it would be good for him to sort of like remember those roots, because he is getting on a bit and it would be nice for
Well, be fine.
him. Who knows? Where can people find you and connect with you?
Through all the social media, through Facebook, Instagram, I'm all on there. Google my name is great because it just comes up with everything.
Yeah.
Tells you what it is. Or I do have a designated website, which is www.olly, Olly art, all one word, .no. It's a Norwegian company. Click on there and you'll see a little bit more about me. But if you want to know more about the work and what I'm doing, is simply Google, because Google's great because it puts everything in one place, and
Yeah.
that's what.
Well, I'll leave links to everything in the show notes for the podcast. So anyone that's listening now, you can find how to connect with Neil there. Now, I don't know if you've listened to any of my previous
Oh,
podcasts. That's absolutely fine. It is not a requirement.
yeah.
But I always end with one question. It's the same question for every guest.
Okay.
It's a bit of a mean one, but and you can take this in any way, big or small, personal, global. But my question is, why is art important?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? It's important because to me it's real, and it's about as artists. We've got lots of things going on in the world, great things and bad things. And artists have that ability to connect with that and produce artworks that hopefully connect with a wider audience. And it's, to me, being in the creative space and being creative is one way of getting the messages across to everybody.
I love that. That's a beautiful response. Well, thank you so, so much.
Brilliant. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And there you have it, another episode of Joe's Art History Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please make sure to like, rate, and subscribe. It does really help in letting other people find us. You can listen to Joe's Art History Podcast on any streaming platform, and you can also watch it in a video format on YouTube.
If you would like to support the podcast in any way, I have now released an Amazon wish list, which you can also find in the show notes below. This will allow you to donate in part or purchase in full an art historical text that is of interest to me and that will help in research towards future episodes. And it would be really wonderful if you've listened to quite a lot of these, if you could buy that as a way of marking patronage towards the podcast, that would be brilliant. If you would like to get in touch, please do. It's always lovely to hear from people. You can email me, joesarthistory@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with me via Instagram, which is @joesarthistory, or you can search for my name, Jo McLaughlin, via Instagram, and you will find me there. That's all we have from the podcast this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'll remind you to keep learning and remember, art is for all. Bye.